dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people whose intelligence I've admired more, as I think most of our countrymen and women have over the years, than that of our first guest. He is Ambassador John Bolton. He has served in a number of capacities in the United States government with great distinction, including as our ambassador to the United Nations. He is the author of Surrender is Not an Option, simply countless op-eds, columns, and other contributions to the public debate about all of the national security issues of our time, and a great friend and guest. We're always delighted to have him with us. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back.
Glad to be with you.
So much to talk about, so little time. Let me throw a couple of them at you. Russia, you have been very, very concerned, as I think the rest of us have been, about what Vladimir Putin is up to, not least his influence operations, which are getting an awful lot of partisan press, especially. Give us quickly, if you would, sir, your thoughts on this meeting that the president had last week with Putin and what we've been learning since.
Well, I thought it was extremely important that President Trump do exactly what he did, which is put to Putin right at the beginning of the meeting and for apparently as long as 40 minutes in a number of different aspects of the conversation, why he was unhappy with Russian efforts to meddle in our elections. And I thought that kind of straightforward talk by the president should have made it pretty clear to Putin how strongly we felt about it. But I thought maybe the most important lesson to come out of it for the president, for Secretary of State Tillerson, who was in the meeting, was to watch completely predictably Vladimir Putin deny to their faces that Russia had tried to do anything to undercut Americans' faith in their democratic institutions, because that was the proof positive about how this Russian government performs in international affairs. It will say or do whatever it thinks necessary, whether it is related to the truth or just happens to be coincidentally related to the truth to advance their interest. And therefore, whatever agreement you make with Russia, whether it's a ceasefire in southwest Syria, an arms control agreement, dealing with them on the Iran nuclear weapons program, talking about their intervention in Ukraine, whatever it is, what Russia says cannot be relied upon. Because I think once you reach that understanding, negotiating with the Russians becomes a lot more realistic. And I think after 8 years of Obama, we desperately need that.
Do you agree with me, Mr. Ambassador, that as we're hearing a lot of talk in connection with the Donald Trump Jr. meeting with a Russian attorney, that this opens the door to, in fact, makes absolutely obligatory an investigation into the sorts of collusion that others were having with the Russians? We certainly have evidence of Hillary Clinton and, for that matter, Barack Obama. Should those be part of the investigations underway now?
Well, I think either part of the investigation or perhaps we need separate ones, because I think in many respects, this really requires something that gives appropriate prominence to the various things that are being alleged here. I mean, I just think that the Clinton campaign, the abuses of the Obama administration in trying to affect the election are equally serious from the perspective of preserving our constitutional process. I mean, we still don't know the extent to which the Obama administration was acting in impermissible ways. But certainly one thing, their supporters in the Democratic Party have yet to explain, which is, if this Russian hacking of our election were as serious as they say, why in God's name didn't Obama do anything about it? This to me is an existential threat to the United States. We are a country founded on an idea about human freedom, reflected in our governmental processes and embodied in the Constitution. And I do think that there's still a lot we don't know about what the Russians did, but I think their fundamental premise is to undermine the faith in our institutions. They're doing it in other countries as well, because then it doesn't matter ultimately what candidate wins. It means our system is being undermined. So if it's that serious, what was Barack Obama doing other than watching the paint dry on his office walls?
Let me ask you, you mentioned Syria and the so-called ceasefire coming out of the conversations with Putin last week. One of the other things that's playing out in Syria as well as in Iraq, of course, is what we're being told is the defeat at long last of the Islamic State. Knowing what you do about the ideology that is animating this outfit, do you believe that we're actually at the point where we are seeing that ideology defeated as well as, for that matter, one of its manifestations in this group, the Islamic State?
No, I still don't think that we're addressing the ideology adequately. I think from both press reports and what I pick up in conversations with knowledgeable people, it's almost certain that the Islamic State has already exfiltrated substantial numbers of its leaders to somewhere else. Libya, Yemen, there are a lot of possibilities. Afghanistan, I mean, they could have left for a lot of different places to reestablish a new caliphate. And those who remain behind in Mosul, where there's still some holding out, in Raqqa, the capital, are ready to get their martyrdom, which they richly deserve, and the sooner the better. But it's not going to end the ISIS threat. And in fact, I think Obama's slow roll strategy of dealing with the ISIS caliphate in Syria and Iraq has permitted ISIS the luxury of being able to regroup elsewhere. And I think the president has a fundamentally different view of the conflict with radical Islamic terrorism. I just don't think his government has come along with him yet. And I think it's a problem that we will see in a number of different areas, most acutely in this one, that the permanent government is not yet under control.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you about not just the permanent government. That's bad enough, most especially the Foreign Service part of it. But even his cabinet officer over there, Rex Tillerson, on the issue of a country that has been very much at the forefront of promoting this, well, Andy McCarthy calls it Sharia supremacist ideology, namely Qatar. You have this sort of spectacle of the president saying it's a good thing that they drive out, effectively, Qatar, if it won't drive out the Muslim Brotherhood and Al Jazeera and so on the one hand. And you have Rex Tillerson not only saying, hey, everything's just hunky-dory with the Qatar, but we're actually now party to a memorandum of understanding about how we're going to join forces with them in countering terrorism. What do you make of this based on particularly your experience in the building?
Well, it's anytime you get a split between the White House and the State Department or any major cabinet to defend the intelligence community, our foreign adversaries take advantage of it. I actually think what the president did in Riyadh and the creation of the Center Against Extremism gave us an enormous opportunity to try and dry up terrorist financing from whatever source it comes from. And, you know, you can point a lot of fingers on this score because the terrorists and their different manifestations get it from a lot of different places. Qatar has one significant point in its favor when it says, you know, you accuse us of giving to the Muslim Brotherhood. It's true, we don't, in Qatar, the Muslim Brotherhood's not declared as a foreign terrorist organization. But, you know, the United States hasn't declared it to be a terrorist organization yet either. So, to me, this is how you take this mess in the Gulf, which I do think we need to clear up. We need a united anti-Iran front, and Qatar needs to come closer to its friends on the peninsula and us and Israel on that point. But in the meantime, let's help Qatar along here. Why doesn't the United States get on with the business of declaring the Muslim Brotherhood a foreign terrorist organization? And that then gives Qatar the excuse to go ahead and do it, too, so we can cut off everybody's funding for them, whether it's in Egypt or the United States or anywhere in the world.
Great idea. Mr. Ambassador, we hope from your lips to God's ears, as they say. We thank you for spending some time sharing with our audience's ears these important insights, and I know you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, sir, stay very well. Dinah West joins us next. We'll talk about Skolkovo and collusion that really is treasonous. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a pleasure to say we have arrived at that point in the week, which I consider to be one of its high points, our visit with Dinah West, a longtime syndicated columnist and blogger par excellence at dinahwest.net, the author of two critically acclaimed best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. She is a contributor, among other things, to the Daily Caller these days and has been very thoughtful, very vocal about, among other things, this controversy concerning Donald Trump and collusion with Russia. I would venture to say that nobody in this debate understands better than Dinah West the nature of the Kremlin under successive regimes, including Putin's. And it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with her about them, especially at a moment when there is fresh grist for the mill on all of this. Dinah West, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
So let's talk a little bit about the fresh grist. Donald Jr. Spoke with others during the course of the campaign, it turns out, with a Russian lawyer. What are we to make of all of this, Dinah, and particularly the degree to which it has seemingly put nitroglycerin into the mix in Washington?
Yes, well, I think that we can officially declare the swamp to have gone starkers.
I didn't know a swamp could go starkers, but let's stipulate to it that it can.
The disconnect from reality, from logic, from history, and indeed from meaning. I think in some ways this is the triumph of deconstructionism. We have completely unshackled ourselves from the whole logic process. The concept of going back to the emails on WikiLeaks, the great crime of the century according to the media, the left, etc. The meaning of the emails is gone. The corruption, the crime, the dirtiness of the content.
What was revealed, indeed. It seems as though not only do the revelations that have been made about, among other things, the nature of democratic collusion, shall we say, with the Russians over the years is simply not being addressed, but that evidence is so much more compelling than anything associated with the Trump team to date.
Well, exactly. Yes, and the point that I would like to make in terms of looking at the way we're supposed to hide our eyes from content, similarly, we're supposed to hide our eyes from the content and the context of Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer. The notion that treason has been introduced, frankly, I am not a lawyer. I cannot believe that there is not a case of slander that Donald Trump has here against these absolutely reckless charges. Charges, I would add, of treason, of malfeasance, of harm to our country that the late, great Senator Joe McCarthy would never have dreamed in a million years of launching so recklessly and fecklessly and without any evidence. What we have here is a meeting, as described in emails released by Donald Trump Jr. Collusion to do what? That is the question we never get to. In this case, it was a fact-finding meeting that promised news documentation of crime by Hillary Clinton, of possible involvement with Russia, which actually Donald Trump Jr. did not need, in terms of how much would be coming out, rolling out over the summer. I can only think immediately, for example, going back to the whole process of how it would be that her own husband, Bill Clinton, while she was Secretary of State, took $500,000 from a very suspect bank in Moscow called Renaissance Capital, which no less than the London Telegraph describes as a firm that employed a string of former KGB spies. This in a recent story about money laundering that has been linked to Renaissance Capital. We need to go a lot further into this to connect any dots, if there are any dots there, or even to explain it to the audience. But this is the kind of red meat.
Let me ask you, Dinah, because you really first brought it to my attention about Skolkovo and that whole saga. Just very quickly, remind us what that was about, again, as an example of the kinds of things that Donald Trump Jr. might well have been exposed to had this conversation amounted to anything. It apparently did not. But more to the point, the kind of thing that the investigations, it seems to me, now must attend to. If there's going to be all of this scrutiny of Trump and Trump Jr. and so on, that at the very minimum, the kinds of things that the Russians might have shed light on with respect to Hillary and Barack Obama, for that matter, should be addressed. And Skolkovo is top of the list. Just again, quickly, tell us about that.
Yes, quickly. And frankly, as the media might have shed light on, all of this is open source material. I mean, this is where we are in the state of our information vacuum.
But Diana, there is evidence of truly treasonous behavior here. And just tell us about what it involved.
Yes. Well, just to give one example, Skolkovo was a tech project that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama engineered on behalf of the Russian government, Medvedev and later Putin, that was to bring in American and other Western technology to ramp up Russian capabilities. And what we see there, and we're seeing there from the early days, in open source, Army reporting, FBI warnings, etc., dual use technology. In other words, technology that could go from civilian to military. And I wrote a piece recently at the Daily Caller called Hillary Clinton's Hypersonic Missile Gap, because in that lovely technology package, we see technology that has now been literally weaponized into extremely advanced technology, military technology, that we do not have. Hypersonic missile technology.
And worse, that we do not have the capability at the moment to defend against, which means as a direct result of this kind of pay-to-play self-dealing by the Clinton Foundation and Hillary and Bill, it appears as though American lives are in danger. And if that's not the test of treason, I don't know what is. So, Diana, I need to switch gears with you to get one other topic, because you've addressed it so brilliantly. I want to make sure our audience is aware of it. But thank you for this important update and your views on this current. But talk a little bit about the Trump speech in Warsaw. And you've recalled to mind a previous speech of a somewhat similar but more robust kind, I guess one would say, by then Prime Minister of Italy, Berlusconi. This is a fascinating story and really important for us to think about.
Yes, well, it already seems to be lost history. Even Rush Limbaugh, who was very taken with the president's speech in Warsaw last week, seems to have forgotten. He thinks this was a first, and he thinks that the reaction to it was a first. The intense opposition to President Trump's applauding of Western society and call to protect it and civilization. And what I was called to mind was the Berlusconi remarks immediately following 9/11, when he was Prime Minister of Italy, whereby he explained why it is that one must separate Western culture from Islamic culture, why it is that Western culture, which brings human rights and liberty and wealth creation to the world, is absolutely superior to Islam because it Islam does not do those things. And the robustness and the clarity, believe it or not, from Berlusconi, who certainly had his own issues in days since, was such that it brought down the world on his head. And unfortunately, he did apologize. I think that Trump's speech in many ways is the heir to that capitulation that Western leaders, with the exception of few, including, say, Geert Wilders of the Netherlands, but how Western leaders and certainly American leaders have all capitulated to this sense of deference.
Yeah, moral equivalency at best, if not outright submission. I'm a rather bigger fan of the Trump speech, perhaps, than you've just described. I take your point about its shortcomings, but I think it's the old line about in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I think we have to take any defense of Western civilization we can find at the moment as a clarion call. Diana, we're out of time. We have to get you back soon. We will do so for sure next week, if not before. But in the meantime, thank you for your insights on all of these points and the great work you do at the Daily Caller. And, of course, dianawest.net. Check it out, folks. Thanks. Up, we'll talk with Bruce Klinger straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Bruce Klinger. These days, he is a senior research fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. He is a man who comes to that role with a considerable and impressive background in the U.S. intelligence community, including long service at the Central Intelligence Agency's Korea branch and as the deputy division chief for Korea. He has written extensively about Northeast Asia and particularly North Korea, among other places, at the Daily Signal. He is frequently called to testify on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, and it is always a privilege to have him with us. Good to have you once again. Bruce, thanks so much for taking a few minutes.
Well, thanks for having me again, Frank.
We have, of course, been following with great interest developments in North Korea, some of them involving the proliferating missile capability of the North, some the ongoing evidence of its improving nuclear weapons capability, certainly its belligerency. Give us a sense, Bruce, of where you think the North Korean threat stands at the moment. How imminent is it to the continental United States in particular?
Well, it's very real, and it's growing. In the last 2 years, particularly, North Korea has really gone on a spree of missile launches. Some of them are tests for the missiles that are still in development. Others are exercising a war plan for the missiles that are already deployed. So right now, the best estimates are that that South Korea and Japan are already under a nuclear threat from the Nodong medium-range missile, which people assess already have nuclear weapons. Then North Korea has had sort of breakthrough successes in two different intermediate-range missiles that can hit Guam, which is a critical node for the U.S. defense of the Pacific, including the Korean Peninsula. And then it also has a submarine-launched ballistic missile, which, when that's finally operational, will make it very difficult to track and, if necessary, target those missiles. And then it is continuing to work towards actually several different ICBM versions. And of course, we saw the launch on July 4th. So right now, the best estimate is that that missile which was flown, it was the first test of it, and it was successful to counter to the perceptions that North Korean missiles always fail. It was flown to an unusually high trajectory, so it wouldn't fly over Japan. And the best estimates are, had it been flown on a normal trajectory, could have gone at least 6,700 kilometers. That's all of Alaska. And it likely has the capability to go far further than that. So perhaps even portions of the continental U.S. And of course, the end objective would be to be able to hit the entire U.S.
Bruce, there are some who continue to express the sense that this isn't that imminent a problem because they haven't perfected the miniaturization of the nuclear weapons that would go on these missiles of longer and longer range, and or that they don't have the reentry vehicle technology down. What's your professional judgment on those two counts?
Yeah, the North Korean missile and nuclear program seem to be slow and methodical. And even when they have a failure, which, you know, any missile in development is going to fail occasionally, particularly in the beginning, they learn and they continue to plod along. So what I found really, though, over the years is it just seems to be a tendency by many to downplay the North Korean threat. There were, back in the day, denials of the North Korean plutonium weapons program, then denials of the uranium-based program, denials that North Korea was involved in building a nuclear reactor in Syria. And then now it seems by some still a downplaying of nuke or missile capabilities. But what we've seen, particularly in the last 2 years, is sort of a lot of surprise by experts of, you know, either a success by North Korea or a missile went further than expected, or given even some photographs of rocket engine tests that North Korea releases, scientists will say, oh, it's got a better engine than we expected. It's using better propellant than we estimated. And there seems to be a lot of surprises, I think, by some experts. So when people say they haven't miniaturized, well, of course, there's no evidence that they haven't. And you know, most experts, including those in the government, think that they already have a miniaturized warhead for the missiles that can range Japan and South Korea. And this test on July 4th, it may have successfully tested a reentry vehicle for an ICBM. We don't know yet.
There are some who say that the missile itself was something of a surprise to U.S. intelligence. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, the particularly the U.S. government was saying that it was a missile that we hadn't seen before. I think many of us thought it had been one of the missiles paraded this year in Pyongyang. So I think people are still hashing out sort of what missile it is and even what the designator is. But there's a bit of confusion on sorting out which missile is which. But we know they have actually several different kinds of ICBMs that they're working on. And of course, they were already having a thing which we call the Taepodong, they call the Unha, which is, they claim, a space launch vehicle, but by putting a satellite into orbit successfully twice, that's an ICBM technology, and governments and experts assess that already has the capability to range the entire continental U.S.
And on this satellite business, one of our colleagues and frequent contributors here, Dr. Peter Pry, has, as I think you know, Bruce Klinger, been talking for some time about the possibility that those satellites themselves could be used as delivery systems, if not in sort of the fractional orbital bombardment system approach that the Soviets used back in the day or had deployed back in the day, then perhaps as a platform for an electromagnetic pulse attack on the United States. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that sounds like a pretty sophisticated system that would be already in orbit. And I think the systems that South Korea put up in December 2012 and February last year, I think are probably more likely to be kind of a Sputnik-like, you know, they got it up there and put it into orbit, and that for them was a great success. Whether they have the sophistication yet to do the different systems you described, that may be beyond their capability right now, but perhaps it's something that they are working on.
Let me ask you quickly, Bruce, and we only have a couple of minutes, unfortunately, but talk a little bit about the responses to all of this. The Trump administration is reportedly putting a bit of a squeeze on the Chinese, not simply taking their word for it that they're going to help on this, but actually creating some costs to them for not putting the kind of pressure they perhaps uniquely can put on the North Korean client state there. What's your reading of what the administration is doing? And very quickly, if you can, what should it be doing that it's not?
Right. Well, there's, I think, two lanes in the road with China. One is the diplomatic side, where we're trying to, whatever, pressure, cajole, and, you know, implore them to fully implement the required UN sanctions. And certainly they've been underperforming on that. They turn a blind eye to proliferation, illicit activities on their soil. The other lane in the road would be law enforcement, and it's enforcing U.S. laws. So because the vast majority of all international transactions, financial transactions in the world, are denominated in dollars, and that includes North Korean and Chinese, they must go through a U.S. bank regulated by the U.S. Treasury. So the U.S. successive administrations have pulled our punches. We have not sanctioned Chinese entities, banks, and businesses that are misusing the U.S. financial system. The second tract is enforcing U.S. law. The U.S. has actually tremendous authority and leverage over Chinese banks and businesses because the vast majority of all international financial transactions in the world are denominated in dollars. And that means they must go through a U.S. bank regulated by the U.S. Treasury. So North Korean entities, Chinese entities that are misusing the U.S. financial system, including money laundering, we not only can, but we must sanction them and take measures. For example, the U.S. has imposed $12 billion in fines on European banks for money laundering for Iran, and we haven't imposed a single penny in sanctions or fines on any Chinese bank. So I'm hoping when the Trump administration sanctioned the Bank of Dandong about 2 weeks ago, that's really the first of many shoes to drop.
It certainly seems long overdue, for sure. And I hope you're right that it will be a precursor to a much more intensive effort to persuade the Chinese that it is not in their interest any more than it is in ours to prop up this regime in North Korea and tolerate its increasingly threatening behavior. Nobody understands it better than you, Bruce Klinger. We're very appreciative of you taking a few minutes to talk with us about it and look forward to doing so with you again in the meantime. Keep up the great work at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center and the Daily Signal as well. We will talk next with Kyle Scheidler about, among other things, Qatar and Mosul and how all of that's sorting out. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I am extremely pleased to say, joined by one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, the director of our Threat Information Office, sometimes guest host of this program, frequent contributor and extraordinary resource for all of us at the center and in the fight. He is Kyle Scheidler. In a previous incarnation, he served as the director for research and communications at one of our friendly collaborators in this battle space, the Endowment for Middle East Truth, better known as EMET. He has written extensively on many of the subjects that we talk about, including for us at the center's own website. You can check him out elsewhere. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, always a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to get, first and foremost, your take on the victory laps that are being run about the defeat, as it's called, of the Islamic State in Mosul. Characterize the state of play as you see it, both with respect to the Islamic State there and, for that matter, in neighboring Syria, but more broadly, Kyle, is this a time for champagne corks to be popped?
Well, you know, there's an old saying that when the battle is over, it's time to tighten your helmet strap. And that's really where we are when it comes to Islamic State, but more importantly, in the fight against jihadists generally and in the fight against Sharia supremacism. So the Iraqi government is happy to declare victory in Mosul, which was a hard-fought victory. But the reality is that the fight is still going to go on. One of the things that's most concerning about the events following the Mosul victory was the U.S. reaction. The U.S. reaction was to applaud the Iraqi government, the Abadi government, which of course is a government very, very close to the Iranians, to explicitly thank the Iraqi militias for their role in liberating Mosul. So you have the U.S. officials applauding a popular mobilization forces, Iranian-led, commanded by a designated terrorist, according to the U.S. This is deeply problematic. It's been part of the problem that our entire campaign against the Islamic State has faced, which is that it has largely relied on Iranian-backed forces as ground troops that we were providing air cover for. Now, we did have other forces that were allies that we could rely on, notably the Kurdish forces and the Syrian Democratic Forces on the Syrian side. But this reliance on the Iranian-backed forces is a serious problem, and the fact that we would applaud them for their role is really tone deaf.
Well, and the problem beyond simply working closely with providing an air force in effect for the Iranians, of course, as you know so well, Kyle Schaudler, is that we are essentially enabling the Shiites in Iraq, backed up massively now by the Iranians, as you say, to help destroy some four of the major cities of the Sunni population of Iraq. That can't go well over the longer term. And in addition, Kyle, is it fair to say that there has been a total failure to date to address the ideology, as you say, I think it's best described as Sharia supremacism, of the Islamic State that will surely manifest itself in one or more other ways, even if we are absolutely successful in liquidating this particular manifestation?
Well, you had a good example of that, given that during the Mosul campaign, you also had Filipino troops fighting an Islamic State takeover of a small city in the Philippines. So this really is a global jihad and a global jihadist movement. And if we don't understand that, we are not going to be successful. And if you look at our statement following the fall of Mosul, it looks like we're prepared to repeat the same mistakes we repeated earlier. You know, we praise the Abadi government. We call on the Abadi government to lead the reconstruction of these Sunni areas and to secure these Sunni areas. If they do that with Shiite militias, you're back in the exact same position you were in when Islamic State conquered these territories, in large part because the populace preferred Sunni jihadists to Shiite jihadists.
The difference being, of course, that most of their cities have been destroyed utterly in the process. Hey, Kyle, speaking of this problem and failing to understand it, President Trump has, as you know, called for these extremists to be driven out of the countries, the mosques, the governments of the Muslim world. In response, it appears, the Saudis, Egyptians, the UAE, and others turned on Qatar as one of the countries that has been very much involved in that business. The president has applauded it, and yet his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, seems to be, well, undermining the president on this at every turn. Talk, what's going on there?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the White House and the State Department are not on the same page when it comes to what's going on in Qatar. You had Tillerson travel to Qatar and signed a memorandum of understanding for countering terrorism with the Emir of Qatar, who is at the center of this entire conflict. And he praised Qatar as being the first state to respond to Trump's call in Riyadh. Now, that is exactly opposite of what President Trump has said, that the actions by the GCC against Qatar were part of his call. So this is a direct opposition to the White House effort on Qatar. And it's noteworthy because it's not the first time. This MOU on Qatar, which is currently being used by the Qataris as a major influence operation to try to take ground and clear up their image, was something that was being worked on for weeks by the State Department, even prior to the Riyadh trip. But their decision to declare it now is particularly timely because it gives the Qataris cover for a leak that came out earlier this week from the Saudi side, where they pointed out that in 2013, the Qataris had signed an agreement where they promised to stop supporting terrorism, stop supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and stop supporting other media outlets to undermine the Gulf states. So the Saudis and others have already pointed out that the Qataris cannot be trusted when it comes to the documents that they sign. And then immediately we have the State Department come out and sign a document with Qatar. It makes no sense.
Well, and then just to make it an even more pointed poke in the eye, as I see it, Kyle, the Qataris engaged in literally the same moment, a new commitment to Hamas in Gaza, a designated terrorist organization, according to the State Department itself. I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. And the question I have is, will President Trump tolerate it? And if he does, I fear that it will be only to further undermine his positions on just about everything else. Hey, quickly, very, very quickly, Kyle, tell us about this gal, Linda Sarsour, speaking of Islamist influence operations. What is she up to, and who has she now acknowledged is one of her mentors?
So Linda Sarsour, who your audience may be familiar with as sort of a perennial Islamist troublemaker, was at the Islamic Society of North America, a Muslim Brotherhood Front organization, annual conference. And while she was there, she got dinged by the conservative press for encouraging a jihad against President Trump. But one of the things that the media didn't notice, but which is even more significant, is that she declared that as her personal mentor was a man named Siraj Wahaj, an unindicted co-conspirator in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and a man who is on audio tape calling for armed jihad.
Yeah. When he talks about jihad, presumably his mentee is thinking that kind of thing, too, not simply speaking truth to power, as her apologists would have us believe. Kyle Scheidler, there's so much more to talk about. We look forward to doing so with you again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for the great work you do as the director of the Threat Information Office at the Center for Security Policy. You can check out his writings there. And where else, Kyle?
You can find me quite often at The Federalist. I have a piece on Linda Sarsour in The Washington Examiner that's worth checking out as well.
Good. We'll be talking with you again soon. We'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Till then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.